Annihilation. Washington's version of what happened next, reiterated and revised throughout his life, does not fit the bulk of the evidence. He claimed that the defenders of Fort Necessity were inflicting heavy casualties on the enemy, more than 300 dead or wounded by the end of the day. So the French commander, Captain de Villiers, decided to call a truce and propose generous terms of surrender. In return for promising to remove themselves from the Ohio country for 1 year, the defenders were permitted to evacuate the fort carrying their arms, their colors, and their honor. In Washington's version, the battle at Fort Necessity was not a defeat so much as a stalemate, in which the Virginians and British conducted themselves with gallantry and composure despite the superior French force arrayed against them. The more unattractive truth was that Washington had placed his troops in a hopelessly vulnerable position at Fort Necessity. He had suffered 100 casualties compared with only 5 deaths on the enemy side. The relentless musket fire and horrible weather conditions had caused the defenders to panic, and the panic only intensified when news of imminent Indian reinforcements created the prospect of a wholesale massacre of the garrison. In the Articles of Capitulation, the French promised to restrain as much as shall be in our power the Indians that are with us. Most awkwardly, the Articles of Capitulation referred to the assassination of Monsieur de Jumonville, meaning that Washington's signature on the surrender document endorsed the conclusion that the British in general, and he in particular, were responsible for murdering a diplomatic emissary of the French crown, which, in turn, meant that the British were responsible for the hostile action that launched the French and Indian War. Washington went to his grave claiming that he never realized that the word assassination was included in the Articles of Capitulation, and blamed the misunderstanding on a poor translation from the French original and the rain-soaked character of the document. He claimed that he would never have agreed to such terms if he had known their full meaning. Given the utterly desperate situation he faced, however, it is difficult to imagine what choice he had, which is probably one reason why he felt obliged to deny any sense of desperation. He led the beleaguered remnant of his regiment out of Fort Necessity on July 4th, a day he surely never thought he would celebrate, with his reputation up for grabs. Horatio Sharp, the governor of Maryland, published a critical account of Washington's conduct at Fort Necessity, describing the battle as a debacle, and Washington himself as a dangerous mixture of inexperience and impetuosity. The French, for their part, found him a convenient symbol of Anglo-American treachery for his role in the Jumonville massacre. They had confiscated his journal at Fort Necessity and cited the misleading section on the Jumonville incident as evidence of his duplicity. The French commander in North America, General Duquesne, identified Washington as the epitome of dishonor. "He lies very much to justify the assassination of Sieur de Jumonville, which has turned on him, and which he had the stupidity to confess in his capitulation. There is nothing more unworthy and lower and even blacker than the sentiments and the way of thinking of this Washington. It would have been a pleasure to read his outrageous journal under his very nose." For French propaganda purposes, Washington became the ideal villain, and he was featured as such in an epic poem published in France designed to demonstrate the evil character of the enemy. Back in Williamsburg, on the other hand, William Fairfax was using his influence to depict Fort Necessity as a noble, if futile, effort to block the French invasion of Virginia's western lands. After all, if the French regarded Washington as a diabolical character, did that not constitute a recommendation of sorts? Responding to pressure from Fairfax and Dinwiddie, in September the House of Burgesses issued an order recognizing Washington and several of his officers at Fort Necessity for their late gallant and brave behavior in the defense of their country. Whatever happened at Jumonville Glen, however ill-advised the futile stand at Fort Necessity, the young man was unquestionably brave. And with the outbreak of war on the frontier, Virginia needed a hero who also happened to look the part. Though vindicated, Washington himself felt frustrated. "What did I get by this?" he asked his brother. "Why, after putting myself to a considerable expense in equipment and providing necessaries for the campaign, I went out, was soundly beaten, lost them all, came in, and had my commission taken from me." The latter lament referred to the decision by the Burgesses not to vote new taxes for a major expedition against the French, which meant that the Virginia Regiment was disbanded into several independent companies, leaving Washington to serve at a lower rank. This struck him as a gross insult. He was touchy about his rank. Lacking aristocratic credentials like Fairfax, or London connections like Dinwiddie, his military position was his primary indication of social standing in the Virginia hierarchy. Rather than accept the demotion, he preferred to resign. He did so in November 1754, all the while convinced that he had found his proper calling as a soldier. "My inclinations," he acknowledged, "are strongly bent to arms." Events were about to demonstrate that he was in the ideal location to exercise those inclinations. Massacre at the Monongahela. The catalyst for these events arrived in Virginia in February 1755 with two regiments of British regulars, a sweeping mandate to assume supreme authority over British military policy for all of North America, and specific orders to launch the campaign against the French menace by capturing Fort Duquesne. His name was General Edward Braddock, a 35-year veteran who knew all there was to know about drilling troops in garrison, something about waging war in the arenas of Europe, and nothing whatsoever about the kind of savage conditions and equally savage battlefields he would encounter in the American interior. His superiors, hunched over maps in London, had described his mission as a triumphal procession through the Ohio country, the capture of Fort Duquesne, and then a campaign to roll up the string of French forts on the Great Lakes and the eventual seizure of all of French Canada. No one even remotely familiar with the mountains, rivers, and Indian tribes within this terrain would have drawn up such orders. Braddock's mission, in effect, was inherently impossible. He made it even more so by proceeding to issue imperious commands to the respective governors and legislatures of Virginia, Maryland, and Pennsylvania for additional funds, thereby alienating all the colonial governments. He sealed his fate completely at a meeting with a delegation of Indian chiefs by telling them that their historic claims to land in the Ohio Valley were worthless, and that British troops had no need for aid from savages, prompting most of the tribes in the region to go over to the French. As Braddock saw it, he commanded the largest and best-equipped military force ever assembled on the North American continent, making victory inevitable. In fact, the campaign was doomed from the start. In the spring of 1755, Washington had no inkling of these larger intractables. He was living at Mount Vernon, which he was leasing from Lawrence's widow, trying to decide what to do with his life. His letter book for this phase is a somewhat contaminated document because he went back to revise his language on two later occasions, 1786 and 87, and 1797 and 98, in order to improve his spelling and syntax and conceal his youthful ambivalence. By restoring his original language alongside the revisions, the modern editors of his papers allow us to recover his confusion at this moment, along with his solicitous and awkwardly deferential attitude toward British authority as embodied in Braddock. In March, he wrote Robert Orme, Braddock's chief of staff, in somewhat stilted fashion, "I must be ingenuous enough to confess that I wish earnestly to attain some knowledge of the military profession, and, believing a more favorable opportunity cannot offer than to serve under a gentleman of General Braddock's abilities and experience." More than the educational experience of serving under a veteran British officer, Washington wanted the patronage that Braddock's stature could provide. "I have now a good opportunity," he wrote his brother, "and shall not neglect it, of forming an acquaintance which may be serviceable hereafter, if I shall find it worthwhile to push my fortune in the military line." His sensitivity about rank, once a colonel he would now be only a captain, was resolved when Orme assured him that Braddock will be very glad of your company in his family, meaning as aide-de-camp on his staff, by which all inconveniences of that kind, rank, will be obviated. He joined Braddock's swelling entourage of horses, wagons, and men at Frederick, Maryland, in early May 1755. Braddock recognized that he faced a massive logistical problem. In order to mount a proper siege of Fort Duquesne according to orthodox European-style standards for success, he required overwhelming superiority in both manpower and artillery. His main force of more than 2,000 men needed to be fed along the route. His heavy cannon needed to be pulled by horses, and all the food for them needed to be carried on wagons, which required more horses, about 2,500 in all, plus the wagon masters and ubiquitous camp women following in the rear. This cumbersome cavalcade, stretching out over 6 miles, had to carve its own road through more than 100 miles of wilderness terrain that Washington knew to be almost impassable, and that even Braddock acknowledged would occasion great trouble and retard me considerably. All of Braddock's extensive military experience worked against him. He knew in considerable detail how to conduct a conventional campaign in Europe, but in the Ohio country, everything he knew proved either irrelevant or wrong. After stepping off at a brisk pace in mid-May, Braddock's column ground to a near halt once it hit the Alleghenies in June. Washington began to sense disaster at this time, writing his brother that "this prospect was soon clouded and all my hopes brought very low indeed, when I found they were halting to level every molehill, etc., to erect bridges over every brook, by which means we were 4 days getting 12 miles. Stragglers were also being killed and scalped routinely, a sign that the Indian intelligence network was fully aware of their location and destination. Washington apprised Braddock that the ponderous pace of the baggage train virtually assured that they would be marooned in Indian country once the snows in the mountains began to make any advance at all impossible. He recommended that a flying column of 1,200 lightly equipped troops be disengaged from the main body and proceed at full speed toward Fort Duquesne. Braddock accepted this advice, probably one of the reasons why Washington never engaged in the widespread Braddock bashing that haunted subsequent accounts of the eventual debacle. Just as the flying column went forward, Washington came down with dysentery and had to remain with the wagons in the rear. He extracted a promise from Braddock that once they approached striking distance of their objective, he would be brought forward to participate in the attack. On July 8th, as the advance party prepared to cross the Monongahela, though he was still feverish and afflicted with a painful case of hemorrhoids that required him to place cushions on his saddle, Washington rode forward to join Braddock. The disaster occurred the following day. Subsequent accounts of the battle, blaming Braddock for a tactical blunder in maneuvering his troops carelessly across several streams, have been discredited. Braddock's mistake was not tactical, but strategic. Not understanding that European rules of war could not be imposed on America without translation. The engagement began as an accident of war rather than a planned ambush. A large reconnaissance detachment from Duquesne of nearly 900 men, two-thirds of them Indians, stumbled upon Braddock's vanguard at the edge of a clearing in the forest, immediately spread out in a semicircle around the clearing, then started firing. The Virginia troops rushed into the woods to engage the enemy at close quarters. The British regulars, obedient to their training, formed themselves into concentrated rows in the open field. Within the first 10 minutes, their ranks were decimated, and panic set in. Despite heroic efforts by their officers to rally them, the regulars broke. The Virginia troops ended up being caught in the crossfire between the Indians and the British. Entire companies were wiped out by friendly fire from British muskets. As Washington described it later, they behaved like men and died like soldiers, while the regulars broke and run as sheep before hounds. Braddock himself, as fearless as he was obstinate, rode into the center of the killing zone and was quickly cut down with wounds in his shoulder and chest. With Braddock down and the other aides-de-camp casualties, it fell to Washington to rally the remnants. Riding back and forth amidst the chaos, two horses were shot out beneath him and four musket balls pierced his coat, but he miraculously escaped without a scratch, while, as he put it, death was leveling my companions on every side of me. Irony as well as destiny made its appearance on the battlefield that day. One of the few British officers to survive unhurt was Captain Thomas Gage, whom Washington would encounter as commander of the British Army outside Boston 20 years later. In the rear, supervising the horses for the baggage train, was Daniel Boone, who also survived to become an American legend. It was a complete debacle. Out of a total force of 1,300 men, the British and Americans suffered over 900 casualties, while the French and Indians reported 23 killed and 16 wounded. For the rest of his life, Washington remembered the scenes of the dead and the screams of the wounded as they were being scalped. Braddock died 3 days into the retreat, and Washington buried him in the middle of the road, then ran wagons over the grave in order to prevent his body from being desecrated and his scalp claimed as a trophy. After reaching safety, Washington wrote his mother and brother to assure them he was alive. "As I have heard a circumstantial account of my death and dying speech, I take this first opportunity of contradicting the first and assuring you that I have not as yet composed the latter." This piece of understated bravado masked Washington's dominant reaction to the defeat, which initially was disbelief that a force so large and well-equipped could be so thoroughly routed. Dinwiddie concurred, confessing that it appears to me as a dream when I consider the forces and the train of artillery he had with him. But the more Washington thought about it, the more he realized that the very size of Braddock's force, plus his cumbersome artillery train, which eventually proved useless, actually contributed to the fiasco. Braddock himself was not personally to blame, but rather the entire way of waging war he carried in his head, which simply did not work in that foreign country over the mountains where the forest-fighting tactics of the Indians reigned supreme. The relationship between officers and troops had to change in the frontier environment because, in this kind of fighting, where being dispersed, each and every of them has greater liberty to misbehave than if they were regularly and compactly drawn up under the eyes of their superior officers. For now, given the obvious fact that most of the Indian tribes were allied with the French, any conventional campaign on the Braddock model into the Ohio country would meet the same fate. The massacre at the Monongahela was a costly and painful way to learn this hard lesson, but Washington learned it down deep, which was becoming his preferred way to absorb all the essential lessons. As for his reputation, for the second time, he emerged from a disastrous defeat with enhanced status. No one blamed him for the tragedy. Braddock was the obvious and easy target. And he came to be called the hero of the Monongahela for rallying the survivors in an orderly retreat. His specialty seemed to be exhibiting courage in lost causes. Or, as one newspaper account put it, he had earned a high reputation for military skill, integrity, and valor, though success has not always attended his undertakings. There was even talk, it was the first occasion, that his remarkable capacity to endure marked him as a man of destiny. "I may point out to the public," wrote Reverend Samuel Davies, "that heroic youth Colonel Washington, who I cannot but hope Providence has hitherto preserved in so signal a manner, for some important service to his country." This proved prescient later on. But for now, it underlined the young man's chief characteristic, which was a knack for sheer survival. The Regiment. In August 1755, though he was only 23, Washington's ascending reputation made him the obvious choice to command the newly created Virginia Regiment. In the next 3.5 years, he recruited, trained, and led what became an elite unit of, at times, over 1,000 men, which combined the spit-and-polish discipline of British regulars with the tactical agility and proficiency of Indian warriors. During this time, the main theater of the French and Indian War, now officially declared, moved north to the Great Lakes, New England, and Canada, making the Virginia frontier a mere sideshow, and Washington himself what one biographer has called the forgotten man on a forgotten front. But if he languished in obscurity from some larger strategic and historical perspective, the experience as commander-in-chief of Virginia's army provided his most direct and intensive schooling in military leadership prior to his command of the Continental Army 20 years later. Moreover, in part because the historical record begins to thicken during this phase, and in part because the young man was growing up, The mere glimpses we had before become fuller pictures, though still fuzzy at the edges. Finally, the Virginia Regiment itself was very much his own creation. The first institution over which he exercised executive authority, and in that sense was a projection of his own developing convictions as both an officer and an aspiring gentleman. From start to finish, he complained, as he would throughout the War for Independence, he had been given responsibilities without the resources to meet them. "I have been posted upon our cold and barren frontiers," he lamented, "to perform, I think I may say, impossibilities. That is, to protect from the cruel incursions of a crafty savage enemy a line of inhabitants of more than 350 miles extent, with a force inadequate to the task." What he meant was that the dominant Indian tribes of the Ohio country, chiefly the Shawnee and Delaware, had interpreted Braddock's defeat as a mandate to maraud and plunder all the English settlements west of the Blue Ridge. The initiative, the numbers, and the tactical advantage were on the enemy's side. "No troops in the universe can guard against the cunning and wiles of Indians," he explained. "No one can tell where they will fall till the mischief is done, and then 'tis vain to pursue. The inhabitants see and are convinced of this, which makes each family afraid of standing in the gap of danger." There were no set-piece battles, just savage skirmishes that often ended in massacres. As he saw it, he was responsible for providing security over a region that was inherently indefensible, the epitome of mission impossible. His effort to change this fatal chemistry began with a plea to Dinwiddie for more Indian allies. "Indians," he claimed, "are the only match for Indians." This was less a statement of racial or ethnic enlightenment than a practical assessment that 10 Indians were worth more than 100 Virginia soldiers in a forest fight. He strongly supported the attempt to recruit Catawba and the Cherokee warriors from the Carolinas and gave orders to his troops to be cautious what they speak before them, as all of them understand English and ought not to be affronted. Despite his best efforts, the Indian populations of the region remained resolutely pro-French, and the decisive factor in making his mission a wholly defensive holding action, which eventually took the shape of multiple forts or stockades strung out on the west side of the Blue Ridge and garrisoned by detachments of his Virginia Blues. They were called that because of their distinctive uniforms, which Washington designed himself. "Every officer of the Virginia Regiment is as soon as possible to provide himself with uniform dress, which is to be of fine broadcloth. The coat, blue, faced and cuffed with scarlet, and trimmed with silver. The waistcoat, scarlet, with a plain silver lace, if to be had. The breeches to be blue, and every one to provide himself with a silver-laced hat of a fashionable size." The officers' uniforms were but the outward manifestation of Washington's larger goal, which was to make the Virginia Regiment a truly special unit, the first in arms of any troops on the continent in the present war. They were to look sharper and drill with greater precision than any group of British regulars. And they were to master the mobile tactics of bush fighting with Indian-like proficiency. Within a year, Washington believed he had created just such an elite force, which, because it was constantly engaged in combat operations patrolling the Virginia frontier, had a battle-tested edge no other colonial or British troops could match. His pride in them was both professional and personal. "If it should be said," he wrote Dinwiddie, "that the troops of Virginia are irregulars and cannot expect more notice than other provincials, I must beg leave to differ, and observe in turn that we want nothing but commissions from His Majesty to make us as regular a corps as any upon the continent." He had come to regard himself as superior to anyone, British or American, in conducting this kind of guerrilla war, and it rankled him that neither he nor his troops were paid at the same rate as British regulars. "We cannot conceive," he complained to Dinwiddie in what turned out to be prophetic language, "that because we are Americans we should therefore be deprived of the benefits common to British subjects." His protest on this score was more personal than ideological. That is, it derived less from any political convictions about colonial rights than from his own disappointment that neither he nor his regiment were sufficiently appreciated. In the spring of 1756, he traveled all the way to Boston, his first trip to the northern colonies, to plead his case for equal pay and higher rank as a British officer to William Shirley, then acting commander for North America, who listened attentively, but did nothing. He was a serious young man who took himself and his Virginia regiment seriously, and expected others to do the same. He also managed to combine a broad-gauged grasp of his mission, in all its inherent frustrations, with a meticulous attention to detail. He drafted literally thousands of orders that all began, "You are hereby ordered to," and then proceeded in language more incisive and grammatically cogent than his earlier writing, to focus tightly on a specific assignment. "If you come upon a massacred settlement, harvest the corn crop before moving on. When constructing stockades, clear the surrounding trees and brush beyond musket range," a lesson he had learned from Fort Necessity. "When a ranger in the regiment is killed in action, continue his salary for 28 days to pay for his coffin. If ambushed in a clearing, rush toward the tree line from which the shots came while the enemy is reloading." Officers were held to a higher standard of deportment, to include controlling their wives. "There are continual complaints to me of the misbehavior of your wife," he apprised one captain. "If she is not immediately sent from the camp, I shall take care to drive her out myself and suspend you." The old adage applied. If God were in the details, Colonel Washington would have been there to greet him upon arrival. The raw material from which Washington recruited his regiment was raw indeed. He kept several rosters of the enlisted men that revealed that most of his recruits were recently arrived immigrants, primarily from England, Ireland, or Scotland, or second-generation carpenters, bricklayers, and tanners from the Pennsylvania or Virginia backcountry. Washington duly recorded their names, age at enlistment, height, trade, place of origin, then a brief physical description. Dark complexion and hair, lame in his right thigh by a wound. Fair complexion, sandy hair, well made. Red face, pitted with the smallpox, red hair. Though he maintained a proper social distance from the enlisted men, he knew most of them personally. And though most of them were older than he was, he cultivated the image of a caring but strict father toward his children. Discipline was harsh. Those found guilty of drunkenness or lewd behavior sometimes received up to 1,000 lashes. Deserters, even those who returned voluntarily, faced death by hanging. A surge in desertions in the summer of 1757 produced a string of public executions. "I have a gallows near 40 feet high erected," Washington boasted to a British officer, "and I am determined to hang two or three on it as an example to others." He suffered no sleepless nights after endorsing the executions. Even when a condemned man made a special plea based on previous bravery in combat, there were clear lines in his mind, and if you crossed them, there was no forgiveness. He routinely contrasted the disciplines of his own regiment with the undependable militia, whom he described as those whooping, hallowing gentlemen soldiers. The ranks of most militia units were actually filled with yeoman farmers, a notch above his own troops in the pecking order of Chesapeake society. But their short terms of enlistment and inveterate independence made them virtually worthless, as he saw it, in a war that put a premium on staying power. They were the wind. His Virginia regiment was the wall. He described one scene in which a 30-man militia unit refused to assist in the construction of a fort unless paid 40 pounds of tobacco for each day of labor. This despite the fact that the fort was designed to protect their own families from annihilation. On another occasion, when reports of a large Canadian and Indian patrol arrived at his headquarters at Winchester, most of the militia assigned to his command declared their enlistments up and simply walked out. Washington resented that his Virginia regiment was frequently mistaken for a mere militia unit. He did not believe you could trust in the principle of voluntarism, or the spontaneous expression of public virtue, to meet a wartime crisis. This was one youthful conviction that he never saw fit to abandon. Indeed, it foreshadowed his low estimate of militia throughout the Revolutionary War. His abiding respect for civilian authority, most especially his insistence on strict obedience to the principle of civilian control over the military, eventually became one of his greatest legacies. But when he commanded the Virginia Regiment, he violated the principle on several occasions, beginning with the whispering campaign he instigated against Dinwiddie when his requests for higher pay, more troops, and greater discretion in choosing the location of forts were routinely rejected. He opened a separate channel of communication with John Robinson, Speaker of the House of Representatives, blaming Dinwiddie for decisions that left the entire Shenandoah Valley, the best land in Virginia, vulnerable to Indian domination. Washington understood the open secret of Virginia politics, which was that the governor's sovereign authority was more theoretical than real, because the legislature had managed to use its constitutional control over money bills as a weapon to limit gubernatorial power. So there were really two power sources to appease, and Washington's covert communications with Robinson represented his realistic response to the bifurcated character of Virginia politics. For over a year, he demonstrated considerable dexterity in negotiating a two-track approach without Dinwiddie's knowledge. By 1757, however, the relationship with Dinwiddie had deteriorated badly, and the official correspondence became loaded with mutual accusations of deceit. Washington charged Dinwiddie with encouraging hostile gossip among the Burgesses about his conduct of the war, which was precisely what he was doing to Dinwiddie. In fact, Dinwiddie had resolutely supported Washington in the back rooms of Williamsburg, despite gossipy criticisms from some Burgesses that he was submitting inflated estimates of Indian strength in order to promote greater tax levies. Through it all, Washington maintained a posture of absolute probity. "But this, no," he wrote Dinwiddie, that no man that ever was employed in a public capacity has endeavored to discharge the trust reposed in him with greater honesty and more zeal for the country's interest than I have done. There was truth in this claim, but not the whole truth, which would have included the behind-the-scenes machinations. Two features of the emerging Washington personality come into focus here. First, a thin-skinned aversion to criticism, especially when the criticism questioned his personal motives, which he insisted were beyond reproach. Second, a capacity to play politics effectively while claiming total disinterest in the game. There was yet another political game he found himself playing, which operated by a wholly different set of rules and at a higher level in the imperial hierarchy. This was the aristocratic game of deference and patronage that he had played successfully with the Fairfax family and had hoped to play with Braddock. The eventual successor to Braddock as the commander of His Majesty's forces in North America was John Campbell, the Earl of Loudoun, who turned out to be another ill-fated and short-lived emissary from London, brimming over with that wicked combination of confidence in his abilities and ignorance of his theater of operations. Upon his arrival in 1756, Washington wrote him in the properly deferential style. "We, the officers of the Virginia Regiment, beg leave to congratulate your lordship on your safe arrival in America, and to express the deep sense we have of His Majesty's wisdom and paternal care for his colonies in sending your lordship to their protection at this critical juncture." He concluded his letter with a special plea based on the loyalty to Britain's goals embodied in the Virginia Regiment, "as it in a more especial manner entitles us to your lordship's patronage." Lord Loudoun represented the privileged and presumptive aristocratic culture that beckoned to Washington as the epitome of influence. In the Virginia Regiment, on the other hand, officers and rangers were promoted on the basis of their performance, and Washington often resisted efforts by Fairfax to have unqualified friends given commissions. But Britain, and to a great extent Virginia as well, still operated within a social matrix where power flowed within bloodlines and where coats of arms trumped merit. Loudoun would have been hard-pressed to distinguish the Alleghenies from the Alps, but by a combination of royal whim and family fortune, he controlled British policy and therefore the fate of the Virginia Regiment and its commander. Washington's attempt to solicit his attention and support for a regular commission was almost comical in its fumbling effort to affect the proper deferential style. "Although I have not the honor to be known to your lordship, yet your lordship's name was familiar to my ear on account of the important services performed to His Majesty in other parts of the world. Don't think, my lord, I am going to flatter. I have exalted sentiments of your lordship's character and revere your rank. Yet mean not this, could I believe it acceptable. My nature is honest and free from guile." Loudoun not only ignored the request, but even decided temporarily to disband the Virginia Regiment in order to send several companies to fight in South Carolina. Still determined to make an impression, Washington named one of his forts after Loudoun, which then proved a lingering embarrassment when Loudoun's failure to mount a successful campaign against Cape Breton caused London to recall and replace him. It seems safe to conclude that Washington understood the rules of the aristocratic game, felt obliged to play by its rules to further his career, but often came off as the provincial American incapable of mastering the deferential vocabulary. For the truth was that he had come to feel superior to his superiors, just as he had come to regard his Virginia regiment as perhaps the finest fighting unit in North America. He and his Blues had learned the hard way how to fight this kind of war and what it would take to win it. Ultimately, the strategic key remained that fountainhead of French power at the forks of the Ohio. But another Braddock-style campaign would surely end up in the same heap of blood and sorrow. Washington believed that he, more than anyone else, knew how to mount a successful campaign against Fort Duquesne, and he expressed only disdain for the various schemes British officers proposed. When he received one such proposal in March 1758, he apprised his purported superior that the plan was absurd and a romantic whim that may subsist in theory but must fail in practice. He ended on a sarcastic note, speculating that perhaps the tactical genius who dreamed up the plan intended to provide them first with wings to facilitate their passage over so mountainous and extensive a country, else whence comes this flight? Nevertheless, something big was obviously brewing. Something designed to move the Virginia frontier off the back burner of British strategy and make the Ohio country a major theater of operations once again. In April 1758, Washington learned that General John Forbes, a Scotsman with more than 30 years of experience in the British Army, had been given the mission of capturing Fort Duquesne with a force over twice the size Braddock had commanded 3 years earlier. Washington immediately wrote Thomas Gage, a fellow survivor of the Monongahela massacre, requesting an introduction to Forbes. This time he dispensed with the awkwardly obsequious tone of the Loudon letter and suggested he was not asking a favor so much as offering one himself. "I mean not, sir, as one who has favors to ask of him. On the contrary, having entirely laid aside all hopes of preferment in the military line, and being induced at present to serve this campaign from abstract motives purely laudable, I only wish to be distinguished in some measure from the general run of provincial officers, as I understand there will be a motley herd of us. This, I flatter myself, can hardly be deemed an unreasonable request, when it is considered that I have been much longer in the service than any provincial officer in America." Forbes and his extremely capable second-in-command, Henry Bouquet, welcomed Washington's advice, in part because they found it compelling, in part because the entire expedition moved beneath the shadow of the Braddock tragedy and needed to avoid his mistakes. First, they agreed to retain a large detachment of Cherokees as scouts, which Washington insisted were the only troops fit to cope with Indians on such ground. Second, they adopted the ranger uniforms of enlisted men in the Virginia Regiment instead of the traditional redcoats of the British Army. Forbes called it Indian dress, adding that, "We must comply and learn the art of war from enemy Indians or anything else who have seen the country and war carried on in it." In effect, Forbes was acknowledging that the Virginia Regiment was the professional model, and the British regulars, the rank amateurs in this kind of campaign. Third, Forbes and Bouquet agreed to train their lead units in the forest fighting tactics Washington had developed. If ambushed, the troops should in an instant be thrown into an order of battle in the woods, meaning they should advance in two groups to the tree line and flank the enemy on the left and right, while the Indian scouts circled to the rear. Finally, the Virginia Regiment would be included in the vanguard, since, as Washington put it, "From long intimacy and scouting in these woods, my men are as well acquainted with all the passes and difficulties as any troops that will be employed." In all respects save one, Washington got his way. But the one exception drove a wedge between him and Forbes that eventually caused him to display his bottled-up contempt for British superiors in a form that verged on gross insubordination. The contentious issue was the proper route to Fort Duquesne. Washington presumed the expedition would follow Braddock's course, across northern Virginia and southern Maryland, then northwest across Pennsylvania to the forks of the Ohio. Braddock's road seemed the obvious choice to Washington because it had already been cut. And it was vastly preferable to all Virginians because it linked the prospective bounty of the Ohio country to the Old Dominion. The clinching argument, as Washington saw it, was that Braddock's road followed an old Indian path, so that the people who knew the region better than anyone else had identified it as the preferred route. The trouble was that Forbes's main force was based at Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and British engineers had proposed cutting a new road straight across that colony, which would be about 30 miles shorter than Braddock's road and did not require an initial detour south to the Shenandoah Valley. It follows much the same course as the modern-day Pennsylvania Turnpike. Washington proposed a special meeting with Bouquet to protest this decision, which he believed had been unduly influenced by Pennsylvanians eager to make their colony the permanent gateway to the American interior. Bouquet agreed, presuming that, whatever the resolution, Washington would accept it as final. "I see with utmost satisfaction," wrote Bouquet, "that you are above all the influences of prejudices and ready to go heartily where reason and judgment shall direct." Bouquet listened to Washington's case for Braddock's road, describing it as sensible, and delivered with that openness and candor that becomes a gentleman and a soldier. 4 days later, after consulting with Forbes, Bouquet apprised Washington that his advice had been heard and rejected. "I cannot therefore entertain the least doubt that we shall all now go on hand in hand, and that some zeal for the service that has hitherto been so distinguishing a part of your character will carry you over the Allegheny Mountains to Fort Duquesne." Bouquet could not have been more wrong. Washington immediately wrote Francis Fauquier, who had recently replaced Dinwiddie as governor of Virginia, to register his vehement opposition to the Pennsylvania route and his moral certainty that the entire campaign was now doomed. He used much the same language with Speaker of the House Robinson, describing the decision as a corrupt bargain designed to swindle Virginia out of its rightful role as the archway to the West, calling Forbes an evil genius in cahoots with the Pennsylvanians, even threatening to go all the way to London in order to expose and discredit him. Throughout the fall of 1758, as Forbes's army hacked its way across the Alleghenies, Washington kept up a steady stream of criticism. Forbes and Bouquet were both incompetent idiots. The pace of the march, slowed by the need to cut the new road, virtually assured that the campaign would stall in the mountains when the snows came and never reach Fort Duquesne. No one should blame him when this inevitable failure happened and all the world witnessed a repeat of the Braddock fiasco. The truth of the matter was that both Forbes and Bouquet were excellent and honorable officers, had very much acknowledged Washington's expertise, and made the decision about the route for logistical rather than political reasons. Forbes, it turns out, was dying, probably of cancer, and made the difficult trek in a blanket stretched between two horses. If anyone were guilty of allowing political considerations to color his judgment, it was Washington, whose Virginia prejudices were blatantly exposed in his letters to Williamsburg. Moreover, his prediction that the expedition would never reach its objective proved wrong. The lead elements of Forbes's column, including Washington's Virginia regiment, reached the outskirts of Fort Duquesne in early November. What happened next might serve as a classic illustration of the unpredictable fortunes of war. Forbes called a council of war to solicit the advice of his officers about how to proceed. The ghost of Braddock had hung over the campaign from the start, and the officers urged caution. Washington himself argued that an assault would be a little imprudent because no one knew the size of the garrison inside Fort Duquesne. Forbes reluctantly agreed. Matters were now at a stalemate, and Washington expressed personal satisfaction that his intimations of futility were coming true, even though he had had a hand in the apparent outcome. But on the next day, November 12th, the Virginia regiment encountered a reconnaissance patrol out from the fort. In the skirmish that ensued, Washington stepped between two groups of his own troops that were mistakenly firing at each other, using his sword to knock up their muskets. Many years later, in 1786, he claimed that his life was in greater danger at this moment than at the Monongahela or at any time during the American Revolution. The regiment suffered heavy casualties, most the result of friendly fire, but captured three prisoners who reported that Fort Duquesne was undermanned and vulnerable. Forbes ordered an immediate assault, with Washington and his troops part of the vanguard. Washington was so concerned about surprise that he ordered all the dogs in the regiment killed before the attack. But when they reached Fort Duquesne, it was deserted and burning. There was no battle, because the French troops, recognizing they were outnumbered, had fled down the Ohio the previous day. It was an empty, anticlimactic victory of sorts. Critical of Forbes to the end, Washington complained to Fauquier that not enough troops were left behind to rebuild and garrison the fort, which would probably be recaptured, and lead to a repeat of the whole bloody business on the Virginia frontier the following year. How to explain Washington's insubordinate behavior during the Forbes campaign, which proved to be an atypical chapter in his long career as a soldier and statesman? Three overlapping explanations suggest themselves, each perhaps containing a portion of the answer. First, he was still very young, only 25, headstrong about his own prowess as the founder of the Virginia Regiment, and over-eager to ingratiate himself with the planter elite in Virginia, which had vested interests in making Braddock's Road the preferred route into the Ohio country. Second, he mistakenly regarded Bouquet and Forbes as updated versions of Braddock and Loudon, imperious symbols of British privilege who thought of American colonists in much the same way colonists thought of Indians, namely as a semi-civilized inferior people. He was factually wrong on this score, but his experience of British authority still smoldered, and his own sense of pride gave that experience a special edge of resentment. Third and finally, he was in emotional turmoil at this moment, because he had fallen in love with one woman and was about to marry another. Love and marriage. The woman he was planning to marry was Martha Dandridge Custis, probably the wealthiest widow in Virginia, with an inherited estate of 18,000 acres valued at £30,000, making her the prize catch of Chesapeake society. All the other eligible women Washington had previously pursued were also wealthier than he was, extending the male tradition in his line of marrying up. Washington had begun courting her in the spring of 1758. The preceding year, he had launched major renovations at Mount Vernon in anticipation of creating a more suitably lavish household, a risky wager on his future prospects made before he knew of Martha's availability, but a sign that he was confident that an appropriate consort would turn up soon. He probably proposed in June. The following month, he stood successfully for election to the House of Burgesses in Frederick County. On one previous occasion, he had permitted his name to be put forward, but had made no concerted effort to win. This time, he mobilized his friends to campaign for him and opened accounts with four taverns in Winchester to provide impressive quantities of rum, wine, and beer at the polls. Even as the Forbes campaign was getting underway, he had already decided to surrender command of the Virginia regiment for a more settled life on the banks of the Potomac with an attractive and much coveted partner. His thoughts were on the new chapter he planned to open up in his life, east rather than west of the Blue Ridge. His emotions, on the other hand, were swirling around another subject altogether. Her name was Sally Fairfax, wife of George William. The evidence is scanty, but convincing beyond any reasonable doubt that Washington had fallen in love with his best friend's wife several years earlier. Just when the infatuation began, and whether it ever crossed the sexual threshold, has resisted surveillance by generations.